This morning, Monday, January 20th, I feel like, the whole day has been an adventure of my own, my personal pleasure. I left early with Wendy and Bess, and we went tourist on regular airline, which seems to have been a fact of considerable interest to the newsmen. Arriving in New York, there was a small cluster of photographers, not many. It just took a nice wave to get into the car and flash off. We were headed for the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where Mary Lasker met me. She was going to be my guardian angel through the tour, but the director, Mr. Rorimer, and the curator, Ted Russo, and Mrs. James Fosberg, and the president of the board of trustees, Mr. Redmond, were on hand, too, to take us through. They took me to a boardroom where they had set aside a group of American paintings that they would be willing to lend to the White House for 2 years. I looked them over. There's nothing that I am quite sure we'll want. There was a Frank Michel called Tom Kenny Comes Home, a cowboy wending his way over a hill, followed by his remuda, a couple of horses that he's carrying along on a rope behind him. It has a sort of a mood quality, and you know when Tom Kenny gets home, there's not going to be enough beans in the pot. A queer sadness. I rather liked it. And then there was a Peter Hurd called Rancheria, which for authenticity, for the wide stretches of sky, for the country of New Mexico and Texas, was quite appealing to me. I think maybe I'll ask them if I may have it. One of the dearest ones was a Mary Cassatt of a mother and child, the child being rather noticeably better done than the mother, or so it seemed to me. So utterly natural and relaxed, and little child didn't have on any clothes. It just had its bath, and its mama was getting it dressed. It was quite a dear picture. And then there was a child handsome called Golden Afternoon in Oregon, lacking in the misty quality that you see in so many of child handsomes, and I think probably the nicest of his I've ever seen, with a single exception of the one in Lyndon's bedroom of Armistice Day, 1918. There was another by Arthur Davies called Unicorns, which had a definitely fae quality, like a fairy story, which I myself liked, but it probably wouldn't be universally enough liked to put down here. Then we spent about an hour just walking through the museum, which I enjoyed tremendously. And one of the things that appealed to me most was the fact that in about every third room we went to, there was a group of school children, oh, say 20 or 30 strong, with a teacher having them in tow, and she would be explaining the pictures to them. I didn't realize there was quite that much exposure of school children to art, and I think maybe it's, can it have been going all along, or is it a new departure? At any rate, it's good for everybody who lives in the town to know the riches of the town. Rather, I should say, the riches of the world, because they are certainly compiled there. Going to the Metropolitan and trying to see it all is like trying to read the Encyclopedia Britannica at one sitting. It can't be done. But I have two sort of favorites that I always take a little look through when I'm there, and one is the mummies. But this time I couldn't see them because there's construction going on and they haven't gotten safely ensconced in their new home yet. The other is the coats of armor that the knights wore in medieval days. And they really must just have been about 5 feet 4 inches tall. We did see those. And it's enormously illuminating to go through with people like Russo and Rorimer, who can point out not only the deeply significant, wonderful things about all that you're seeing, but also the funny little gossipy things. From the Metropolitan, we went to the Whitney Museum, and there I was met by Mr. Bauer and Mr. Gordon, who took me on a brief trip through, and then to see the pictures that they might be able to let us have. There were two Grant Woods in a sort of brown sepia. They were unfinished, and they were the interior of an American farmhouse while dinner was being prepared for the threshers. That had a nice nostalgic quality. Probably not dignified enough for Lyndon's office, but perhaps the fish room. And then there was a little American primitive that just made you merry to look at it, with little old Fords of vintage about 1921, I guess. You know, the infinite detail of the American primitive. There's something ever so appealing about them. Next, it was on to Mary Lasker's for lunch, where she had gathered together in her charming house that is just like the setting for the jewels, the pictures of the jewels. Some very interesting guests. Anthony Bliss from the Metropolitan Opera, and our friends who'd accompanied us this morning, Ted Russo, the curator. Mr. Fosberg was along this time with Mrs. Fosberg, Roger Stevens of the Cultural Center, Lem Billings, Mr. and Mrs. Rarama. It was the creme de la creme of cultural New York, and I felt alien but interested. Any part of the art world that I participate in this job that Lyndon and I have, will be because I really like it, without being able to take the credit for any deep knowledge of it. But if it can highlight, pinpoint, to use a crude word, advertise art for me to do it, whether it be paintings or plays or opera, it'll be something I'll enjoy doing and will try to sort of keep off of Lyndon. Mary so graciously and kindly offered to let me have on loan something from her house. I'm just not a natural born saleswoman, pusher, and I think she'd just have to pick it up and bring it down here and say, "This is where it belongs," before I would do it. Of all the lovely things in our house, the really the loveliest is the big picture window that looks out over the river with the boats plying their way up and down, and the gray stretches of that magic city. That night, rather early, because the theater was going to be at 7:30, and that, after all, was what I had come to New York for. Abe, Ambassador Stevenson, Bennett Korn, Mary Lasker joined us, Wendy and Bess and me, in our lovely suite at the Carlisle, and we had some drinks and some sandwiches, and then set out to see After the Fall. This is the first production of the new Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center, but because Lincoln Center isn't finished yet, the play was actually held in the Anta Washington Square Theater in Greenwich Village. After the Fall is by Arthur Miller, who's been absent from the theater from rather a long time, it seems to me. I remember Death of a Salesman, which I'm just enough of a lover of Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams to have enjoyed tremendously, if you can use the word enjoy. I didn't see View from a Bridge or any of his others, but he's been gone a long time. In this one, well, he sort of saws off the top of his skull and slits open his heart and lets you look in to the agonies and the awareness of a very intelligent man during the last three or so decades. The Depression, the Nazis, the war years, the period after, when a lot of people were being called up in front of congressional committees for questioning about being communist, he was one of those called. And also the two unsuccessful marriages that he lived through with much pain, and the one that he was just entering on. And if I was number three, I'd think I'd feel a little shaky. It was highly autobiographical, but if one doesn't write about what one has lived or what one knows about, what else is there? I thought it was magnificently written. I want to get it and read it. There was a line about holding the future in your hand like a vase. There were just any number of magnificent phrases. I like good English. And then it was acted so well by Jason Robards that I just wondered why he wasn't a sweating, fainting man at the end of it, because he carried such a load for about 2.5 or more hours. The load is principally carried by the protagonist, although the women do have very strong parts, lots of strong parts. There aren't any weak parts in the play, it seemed to me. And there was a little girl named Barbara Loden who played Marilyn Monroe. And later on, I asked her, "What have you been in before?" And she said, "Nothing on the stage. I had a part in Splendor in the Grass in the movie. It wasn't a big part. Elia Kazan directed it." All in all, I think every last one of them got out of it every drag of misery, every bit of beauty, and every now and then one small moment of humor, but I'm afraid I wasn't quite up to joining in the humor. I was so overpowered by the rest of it. Of course, the play centered heavily on the years that he spent with his second wife, Maggie, who is patterned after Marilyn Monroe, who was his wife in life. And it's tenderness and agony and torment and just marvelous acting. At first, I thought I was going to mind it because there were no stage sets, nothing but just some a big stage with sort of some big gray cubicles here and there that one could sit down on. But you became so absorbed in the characters that the absence of sets was completely unnoticed. I wonder what the critics will have to say of it. I hardly see how they can brand it as anything but magnificent. And yet, if Marilyn Monroe left a legacy of love, there will be those who will be angry that he wrote it, and there will be those that will say it was bad taste. After the play was over, we went to the Loeb Student Center in New York University, to a great big room full of tables where there was a champagne supper, a lot of food put before me, and none of it eaten, and practically none of the champagne drunk because there was a flash bulb going off every minute. But one or two precious moments to get to talk to Jason Robards, except that in a crowd that big, I can't really express what I feel. And also a moment to talk with Arthur Miller. Across the table from me was Barbara Loden, whom I could tell how wonderful I thought she'd been. Myrna Loy and Lauren Bacall were there. Lauren Bacall is now Mrs. Jason Robards. And Mayor Robert Wagner came in and sat beside me with the very sad news that his wife is sick. It doesn't sound like a good prognosis. And during the play, I sat next to that delightful Dr. Carlos Sosa Rodriguez, president of the UN General Assembly. I saw Marietta Tree and I believe Jean Kenton at a distance. And Pearl Mester was there. Pearl Mester is everywhere. As far as I'm concerned, the whole evening, what it meant was that maybe they'll get enough from those $50 tickets and $75 tickets and $100 tickets, it being a benefit, to really get the repertory theater going. And that, I think, will be a good thing. And whatever the critics say, I know this is a magnificent play. Although, after watching it, you're just as tired as if you'd cloud all day. That is, if you've got any feelings at all. One of the nice moments of the evening is when a group of Greenwich Village Democrats came over and presented me with a little booklet about their own unique part of New York. And also, another nice thing, it's always pleasant to be around Adlai Stevenson. He escorted me home, probably too late for his hard day's work next day, but not too long for my own enjoyment. And I got back to the Carlisle feeling very self-indulgent and very satisfied.